Good morning, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you so much for taking time to join us on our Anatomy of a Trade Secret Audit. Today's event is being recorded, and we have a very large audience joining us here today, so we do want you to participate in the question and answer period, and so just type your questions down in the lower right-hand corner of the screen where it says Q&A. Know that we do have a very large audience, and we'll do our best to get to each and every one of the questions that do come in. As a reminder, this event is being recorded, and without further ado, it's my privilege to turn the call over to Sehar Shah. Please proceed.
This presentation has been prepared by Sehar Shah for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or a legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance form sent after today's webinar. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. I will now turn the presentation over to Robert Milligan.
Good morning and good afternoon. My name is Robert Milligan. I'm a partner in the Los Angeles office of Sehar Shah. Thank you for joining us for today's webinar program. It is the second webinar of our 2011 series. Today's webinar program is entitled The Anatomy of a Trade Secret Audit. Today's panelists are myself, Bob Neiman, and David Monachino. Bob is a partner in our San Francisco office, and Mr. Monachino is a partner in our New York office. Sehar Shah presently has 9 domestic offices and 1 office in London. We have 55 dedicated trade secret computer fraud and abuse and non-compete attorneys. We're happy to share this program with you about a very important topic that you've seen a lot in the news recently concerning trade secret theft. During today's program, we'll cover a number of items. The main items that we'd like to cover in this overview of a trade secret audit are, first, identifying trade secrets and secrecy protections. What you'll find during our presentation is that the first step in a trade secret audit is first identifying what information is protectable as a trade secret. We will also cover effective secrecy protections, including employment and non-compete agreements. As the other essential element of a trade secret audit, an analysis of the secrecy protections in place and making recommendations about effective secrecy protections. As part of an analysis of those protections, one particular area that we look at in conducting the trade secret audit is effective hiring and termination protocols, including exit interviews. We will also discuss the enforcement of trade secret protection through litigation. We found in our experience that companies that do not actively pursue litigation to protect their trade secrets can be susceptible to an argument of waiver, that they don't do anything to protect their trade secrets when others steal. The other topic we'll cover in today's presentation is employing a comprehensive approach in trade secret protection plan. And that, in sum, is what this presentation is today about, is that conducting a trade secret audit, what are the nuts and bolts of a trade secret audit, and how a company can put together a comprehensive trade secret plan. And with the advent in technology, we'll also address ways companies can manage and work to protect computer stored data. There's been numerous articles and stories in the news recently about breaches based upon computer fraud and also security breaches. We'll cover some of those as well. There's been a number of recent headlines recently that show the importance of having adequate trade secret protection in place and the vulnerabilities that companies can have if they're sued, or the awards that companies can obtain if they sue others for trade secret theft. One recent case is the St. Jude case. It was a Los Angeles-based case where a jury awarded a $2 billion jury verdict against a former engineer. Another case that's been in the news recently is a former Goldman Sachs programmer who was convicted and sentenced to 8 years in prison under the Economic Espionage Act. In that particular case, the programmer stole trade secret code from Goldman Sachs and uploaded it to a computer server in Germany and later tried to use it in a job interview for a company in Illinois. Another case that's been in the news recently is the Mattel versus MGA case. And in that particular case, the jury recently awarded over $80 million for trade secret theft in a case where there was allegations that the Mattel had used corporate espionage actors to go to to trade fairs and misappropriated trade secrets of MGA at the trade fair. The jury awarded $80 million, and MGA is currently seeking over $400 million for attorney's fees and punitive damages as a result. Other recent headlines that show the threat to trade secrets is the advent of WikiLeaks, a website that allows whistleblowers to upload confidential and proprietary data to the website and for the data in its entirety, along with commentary, to be posted and accessible to the world. Another recent case that came out just a few days ago, Accenture was hit for a $94.4 million jury verdict in Texas. Again, a reminder of the risks of your trade secrets being stolen and the consequences when they are. I wanted to provide a little bit of detail about the St. Jude case because it'll highlight some of the key practice recommendations that we'll make as part of a trade secret audit. In this particular case, the defendant was an engineer who had joined St. Jude and worked for the company for a period of time with that provided access to the company's key trade secrets and then decided to leave. In the defendant's exit questionnaire, in his exit interview, he indicated that he was leaving to pursue his personal dream. Now, when the case eventually went to trial, St. Jude's attorney told the panel of the jury that Dr. Zhao's pursuit of his personal dream became St. Jude's personal nightmare. And it was this particular indication in his exit questionnaire, which could have been a big red flag for St. Jude as far as what the defendant Zhao's intentions were. In the case, St. Jude showed that Zhao had unimpeded access to the company's database on its computer network, including sensitive technical documents, and that he had used his access to those trade secrets and taken them to a Chinese-based competitor that was actually founded by Zhao. The attorneys for St. Jude focused on a specification sheet that Zhao took, and this particular specification sheet was provided to a third-party manufacturer just 2 weeks after Zhao left St. Jude. In the particular document, which St. Jude considered a highly confidential trade secret, they showed that Zhao and his new company were so sloppy in the handling of the particular document that was stolen that they had left a column that was clearly marked St. Jude part numbers. And they used this as evidence to convince the jury that misappropriation had occurred and that the jury should award a large verdict. And in fact, they did. It was a $2.7 billion verdict. Another case that's been in the news recently that teaches us of the importance of a trade secret audit is the Goldman Sachs criminal conviction under the Economic Espionage Act. In that particular case, a Goldman Sachs computer programmer was arrested on charges that he stole from the bank's high-frequency trading platform, which is quite lucrative to Goldman Sachs. And he used that particular source code and offered it to a competing company. He was charged with theft of trade secrets, transportation of stolen property, and unauthorized computer access. According to the indictment that he was later convicted on, he transferred Goldman computer code for his trading platform to an outside computer server in Germany. Prosecutors said that he encrypted the files and transferred them over the internet without informing Goldman Sachs and without their consent. The employee's defense, in part, was that the source code was open source code and was not protectable trade secrets. The jury rejected that argument and found that though some of the source code may have been open source code, there was at least some Goldman Sachs source code contained within the information that was transferred, and they convicted him and sentenced him, and he was later sentenced to 8 years in jail. One of the key facts in the case was that the employee had regularly emailed Goldman material to his personal email account. And finally, on his last day, he uploaded code from Goldman Sachs server to a server in Germany, compressed it, encrypted it, and took it to him in a meeting for a new employer in Chicago less than a couple weeks later. The jury found that these facts were compelling, and as indicated, he was sentenced to jail. We briefly mentioned another key advent in technology that is a threat to all employers, and that is WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks is a publicly available website in which whistleblowers and others can upload documents anonymously. The focus on the documents to date has been on government classified documents, including government cables and other embassy-related documents. Other companies have been affected as well by WikiLeaks, including Bank of America, where confidential information regarding Bank of America was uploaded to WikiLeaks by anonymous posters. Once information is uploaded to WikiLeaks, it's publicly available and it can be easily distributed. Before we get into the nuts and bolts of today's show, we wanted to provide a brief overview of what our program is about, and that is essentially the anatomy of a trade secret audit. Now you may ask, what is a trade secret audit? In short, a trade secret audit is an assessment of a company's information and determination of what particular information may qualify as a trade secret, and then an assessment of how that information is being protected by the company, and a net assessment of how that information should be protected better. It's often concluded in a recommendation report, and ultimately a trade secret protection plan is employed. Many companies conduct trade secret audits, and they find that they're useful in protecting their trade secrets. What we have found as trade secret litigators is that a trade secret protection plan is essential if a company later wants to either sue for trade secret misappropriation or wants to adequately defend themselves in a suit brought against them for trade secret protection, trade secret misappropriation. In keeping with our theme of a trade secret audit and the anatomy of a trade secret audit, we found that there's certain components. First, the trade secrets are the heart of a company. They can be the lifeblood of a company. And in protecting those trade secrets, it's important to come up with a comprehensive plan. First of what those trade secrets are and how they're presently being protected. And we view that as sort of the brain analogy. And it's about a company thinking out what its information is, how it's protecting it, and how it can do a better job of protecting that information. And in coming up with that comprehensive trade secret protection plan, companies should rely upon their awarenesses, such as their eyes, their ears, their nose, touch, and taste. So the employees that are in charge of putting together the trade secret protection plan should rely upon those senses when formulating their plan. For example, in formulating policies, they should think about what type of information they want employees to have access to and what their eyes will be able to see. The other key thing is, in assessing your trade secret protection secrecy measures, is to look at misappropriation and how your information can leave your company. And oftentimes, it is with hands, feet, and eyes. A simple stroke of a keyboard or a voice message, and your trade secrets can be compromised. So in formulating the trade secret protection plan and coming up with recommendations, you often want to assess what the employees are doing and what they have access to and how that trade secret information can leave your company. Another key component of the trade secret audit is assessment of litigation, and that can often impact your stomach, because anyone that's been involved in trade secret suit can know that there can be very precarious moments, and it can be very expensive, and that really impacts the stomach. At this time, I'd like to turn the program over to Bob Neiman, who will discuss what a trade secret is.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Bob Neiman speaking from San Francisco, and welcome to our webinar. I'm going to be going over the starting point of a trade secret audit, which has some basics in it, which many of you probably know about. But when we do a trade secret audit, we start from scratch and go through the first question, which is, what is a trade secret? Or in the event of an audit, we would be saying, is it a trade secret? Trade secret protection is based upon your efforts and your interpretation of what a trade secret is. Things such as patents and trademarks and copyrights are all registered, and they have been analyzed by some governmental agency and determined to be fit as a patent or a trademark or a copyright. But there's no real review for a trade secret unless it's done by the court, and usually you want to know in advance whether your item is going to be a trade secret or not. So we go back to the basics of a trade secret to identify if you have one. Many times clients are disappointed to find out that they may have confidential information or proprietary information, but that doesn't always rise to the level of a trade secret. So a trade secret is something that is not commonly known, and you have taken protection to keep it a secret and maintain it in a place safe enough such that the court would give it credibility as a trade secret. Let's go to our next slide. Let's take a look at how the courts interpret what a trade secret is, at least in California. And since I'm a California lawyer, most of my focus is going to be on California law. But in the event that there are other states that we can talk about, we will. And my partner, David Monachino, will give you his interpretation on some New York issues as well. So the trade secret laws in California are under the California Uniform Trade Secrets Act. There are 46 other states that have similar statutes. Some are more stringent, others are more liberal. And when you're doing your audit, you should be taking a look at which states you do business in and making sure that your trade secret complies with each of the requirements under that particular state's Uniform Trade Secrets Act. Now, under the California Trade Secrets Act, there are 8 things that a court may look at to see if you have a trade secret. It could be a formula, a pattern, a compilation, a program, device, method, technique, or process. And it could be any one of those, or it could be a combination of those. So that's step one, is to determine if it falls within the purview of the Trade Secret Act. The second, it has to derive independent economic value. It might look like it follows one of these patterns or compilations, but it has to stand on its own feet as having value, independent of anything else. And then it has to be the subject of efforts that were reasonable under the circumstances to protect it, unlike a patent or any other type of intellectual property that is protected by a governmental agency. Trade secrets are your requirement to protect them. It doesn't have to be Fort Knox, but it has to be something reasonable under the circumstances, and the court will look to that. Let's go to our next slide. To identify trade secrets, you want to have people who know what trade secrets are, and so that they can look at them and decide if they fall within that or not. Unlike patents and trademarks and copyrights, trade secrets are unique by each situation. It might be a trade secret under certain circumstances, and it might not under others. When you're defining what your trade secret is, it should be narrowly tailored, and you should avoid using boilerplate language to identify a particular trade secret. Identifying trade secrets in advance of litigation will give you a better opportunity to control how the court might enforce it. If you're trying to establish it as a trade secret after it is taken from your company, the courts might look at that dimly, that you have not identified it nor taken the adequate remedies to secure it. In litigation in California, when you are filing a trade secret case and claim that someone violated a trade secret of yours or took it, the court requires that you provide a description of the trade secret with reasonable particularity. And therefore, when doing a trade secret audit, you should start with that idea that you're going to narrowly tailor and describe the trade secret with reasonable particularity. Let's take a look at some examples of trade secrets. This is a very small list, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. And at the end of this program, in addition to receiving the PowerPoints we also are going to provide you with two different checklists. The first checklist is what we call the audit plan checklist, which has all of the technical things that you might look for in a trade secret audit, similar to the ones we have here on this slide. Our other trade secret checklist is going to be one that deals with the human factors or the employee relations checklist that you should incorporate when dealing with employees who are beginning in your company or leaving your company. Let's take a look at the examples of the trade secrets, and again, these are fairly broad. The first one is the tangible customer list, and this is often the holy grail of trade secret litigation. The vast majority of the cases that I've handled in my career often involve customer lists, and many of them fail because they were not kept secret enough or they lacked independent value. When you're the defendant in one of these cases, your favorite thing to do is to hold up a phone book and say, Your Honor, every one of the people on the customer list of the plaintiff is in this phone book, and I have their phone numbers as well. So if you're going to have a customer list and you're going to try to keep it as something that is going to be protected, you have to add some additional things to it to embellish it, such as, at the bottom of this slide, knowledge about customers. For instance, if you ran a catering service and you just had the names of the people that you catered to, that wouldn't necessarily have much value. But if you had the days that they celebrated holidays, the types of food they enjoyed, the number of guests that they usually asked to help them with, and a bunch of other additional items that would make you want to keep that list very, very secret, that might be something that the court would look at and say that this would cause irreparable harm for this list to be utilized by a former employee or a competitor, because it's something you spent a lot of time to create. And that's something the courts also look at, the time and the value that you put into the trade secret, particularly if it is a customer list. But other trade secrets include formulas. That's often comes up as well. A manufacturing process, marketing strategies, sensitive financial information. Pricing information is also something that I encourage clients to weave into a customer list that they can show to the courts that they spent a lot of time determining the needs of their customers and that this is something that should be protected. Nowadays, of course, unique software and source codes enter more into it on a daily basis, and Robert's going to cover some of that when we get into the new technologies. Let's go to the next slide, please. This is an example of where we find trade secrets, and when we do your audit, we would need to examine all of your resources. Our audit checklist goes on for several pages about the locations where trade secrets can be located, but this is just an example of where trade secrets can be found. Generally speaking, the two places that we find them most often are computer files and databases. And there's always a question about the access that was given to an employee to these two locations. If it's a rare and unique trade secret, less access will be given to those and only on a need-to-know basis. Some of the trade secrets that we've talked about may be in one's head, as they say. And then we get into the inevitable disclosure doctrine, which we do not have or honor out here in California. But in some states, the courts say that what an employee takes out in their brain, they have the right to use later on. And therefore, protecting that as a trade secret is something that you'd want to do, even if we don't have inevitable disclosure in certain states. Why protect trade secrets? It's pretty obvious why we do it. You want to protect your market share. Your customer list could be taken, and without proper protection, a former employee or a competitor can reduce your market share substantially. California does not allow non-compete contracts or provisions within an employment contract, which might ordinarily help moderate very high employee mobility. But you can moderate employee mobility by having agreements in the employment contracts that would restrict them from taking trade secrets and or confidential and proprietary information. But I have found that many employees who take information, particularly formulas and methodologies of doing business, are not going to hand that trade secret over to their new employer. Instead, they're going to use it on a day-by-day basis to impress the new employer that they hired a very good employee and that they're one of the smartest people that they've ever hired in a long time. So the trade secret may not leak out immediately. It may be used over time elements in here: a confidentiality agreement, a return of materials agreement, and an invention assignment agreement. These should be standard in every contract, but again, it should be tailored to the position that the employee has rather than just using boilerplate language. It should include injunctive relief that could be allowed by the court to protect your trade secrets if necessary, as well as damages for any trade secrets that one of your employees may walk off with. And it should also include attorney's fees where it's allowed in certain states. Our Uniform Trade Secrets law in California does allow for attorney's fees to be awarded, but that would be after a judgment, and it's not mandatory. It is more of a may statute rather than a shall statute. Also, a vendor independent contract agreements should have some type of a non-disclosure or trade secret agreement. Oftentimes, third parties or agents are brought in to do work on projects as consultants, and they also need to have some type of a non-disclosure agreement. Due diligence agreements, we see this every day, where one company is looking at another company to purchase the company, and you need to have in place a non-disclosure agreement that trade secrets will remain the property of whichever company has them, and that at the end of the due diligence, whether or not the companies merge or do their business together, there will be a return of all property. And lastly on this slide, the courts look very carefully at prior breaches of any type of security. If your employee departs and finds that you had another employee earlier that left and that you let that go and you did not enforce it, there will be a claim of waiver and estoppel that you did not enforce the trade secret the first time. So be cautious that just letting it go the first time might be a waiver or an estoppel against the second claim by an employee who departs. That's our next slide. Reasonable efforts to maintain security. I think I mentioned this, but courts weigh heavily on what access an employee has in the first place. There should be restricted access to particular areas of your facility where trade secrets or information that is proprietary or confidential is kept. It should be on a need-to-know basis, and people that are allowed access to this information should be restricted only to the access to the information that is necessary. There should be a periodic review of the access records with your employees, and particularly with your IT department. Your IT people are often your eyes and ears to employees who may be taking information on an unusual or peculiar circumstance. Particularly if they're getting ready to leave and they've announced their resignation, they'll approach an IT person to try to get information that they claim is theirs or that they want to take with them as some type of recollection of their job. This is when you have to be very vigilant. And the courts will look to see what you have done in the past regarding any breaches. Again, our last mention here at the bottom is you must take action to remedy breaches of security because the courts will look to see if that's been done before as well. Some of the things you can do to maintain reasonable efforts of security, and this is where the IT department should also be involved, is password protection, email and electronic data policies, and confidential reminders on screen. And these should be employed in your day-to-day operations as standard working conditions. You must take action against breaches, as we said before. Regular training on policies, this should be something that's done on a periodic basis, at least once per year, if not more often. And finally, exit interviews and documentation. Our trade secret checklist has some information about exit interviews and documentation. This is something that should be done with every employee, particularly ones who have had access to proprietary, confidential, and trade secret information. And at this point, they should be reminded of the obligations under the contract that they have with the company, that they have signed regarding trade secrets, and that they are expected to maintain the secrecy of the information from the company, and that they are to return all documents and all computers and all data accessing items that could be used to regain access to trade secrets. Non-compete agreements. In California, we do not allow non-compete agreements under Business and Professions Code 16600, and although people tried for quite a while to figure out some way around it, our Supreme Court came down in 2008 with the case of Edwards versus Arthur Anderson. In that case, they said that Business and Professions Code 16600, which says that non-compete agreements are void means just what it says. They're not allowed in California. Now, the question is, how can you enforce some of these other opportunities to keep employees from taking information or from competing against you? Some companies try to have a choice of law provision outside of California, which sometimes our courts will give credibility to if it's reasonable. But if you're a California corporation and the employees are in California, it's going to be difficult for the court to agree to apply the laws of the state of Oklahoma or someplace else where they have non-competes. What we find here in California is that a lot of employees that have legitimate non-compete agreements in other states will parachute into California to take a job so that they can file a declaratory relief action and cleanse themselves of these non-compete agreements. If you operate in many other states, you can have a choice of law provision as long as it is reasonable, and that could, I use the word could, be binding on a California employee if it is reasonable that they agree to the choice of law that might have restrictions such as non-compete agreements. And we'll talk in a moment about how this affects other types of non-compete situations such as solicitation. But first, there's a discussion here about forfeiture or penalty for competition. I've seen this in some agreements where an employee would forfeit something such as additional compensation or bonus if they were to take trade secrets or reveal confidential information. You have to be careful with that, folks, because that could violate some wage and hour law, and so you should talk to someone who does wage and hour law if you're going to have that kind of penalty in any kind of contract. Solicitation of customers, California, I believe, would claim that that's just merely another way to have a non-compete agreement, and we've debated this amongst ourselves, Robert and Dave and I, but we wonder if the courts would enforce in California a non-solicitation against customers, and I've argued it from both sides of the bench since the Edwards versus Arthur Anderson case. I think that that the courts at this point are saying that you cannot solicit customer, you cannot have non-solicitation of customer agreements in your California trade secret contracts, but that is something that we can still debate. The better way, of course, is to have that the employee will not use any type of trade secret, proprietary, or confidential information. And the solicitation of co-employees is also up in the issue right now as to whether that can be done in terms of a contract that has a provision to not solicit employees. Again, that's something that in California is still under debate. If your state allows non-compete agreements, they have to be reasonable. They have to be reasonable in terms of time, they have to be reasonable in terms of scope, and they have to be reasonable in terms of geography. If your employee works for you for only a year or two, the court would not likely uphold a 10-year limitation on their employment throughout the entire United States in any part of the industry. That would just probably be too broad. And what you should do is consult your local authorities as to what types of non-compete agreements would be allowed in your jurisdiction and the reasonableness of them in terms of their scope. All right, next slide. The misappropriation is defined under California law, and it's here on this slide. The trade secret normally has to be taken intentionally. There has to be some type of understanding that the person has taken it as opposed to just stumbling upon it. We've had instances, however, where sometimes a innocent person ends up having a trade secret because they might be a consultant or they might be a third-party purchaser, such as a bona fide purchaser, of an item that contains a trade secret. So the courts, if they're going to enforce the misappropriation, they want you to prove that not only did you take the steps to protect it, but that the person who actually took it did it with improper means, with the intention of using the trade secret for their benefit. And this is under our California Civil Code. And now we're going to get into trade secret litigation and how that is enforced. And I'm going to be turning this program now over to my partner David Montechino in New York, Dave and I will be joining you with some later slides. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'll try to speed this up a bit because we only are limited to an hour, but I think from what you've heard so far, it's not that always easy to define what a trade secret is, and courts wrestle with it all the time, lawyers wrestle with it all the time, and clients are often confused. That's, in and of itself, one reason to have a trade secret audit to see what you have and to see what you can do to protect it. So for the slides that I'm going to be talking about, a lot of these slides in the context of obviously why an audit is helpful. The first topic in slide 20 is an injunction. Trade secret cases are really won or lost mostly in the first couple weeks. Every client calls up saying, I need a TRO, someone's taken my confidential information, their trade secrets, their business is going to go under. And our first job as lawyers is to say, okay, what they take and why is it important? And clients are often at a loss. So if you have an audit, you can clearly define, what is a trade secret and what steps you've taken to protect it, rather than spending 3 weeks trying to figure that out and spending a lot of money needlessly that could have been saved if we right up front and told you the best practices and with policies and procedures. You could run into court very quickly, be very prepared, and courts appreciate that, and you have to be very pragmatic and specific to courts if you're going to get an injunction. The next type of injunction, a locatory appeal, would be a preliminary injunction in New York. That would be with a hearing, and it's much easier to talk to people that are controlled with trade secrets early on before litigation starts, to see what they have and who the key players are, and if it's even worthwhile to spend a lot of money trying to enforce a TRO against maybe an employee that really doesn't have confidential information. And in these cases, money damages are often very, very difficult to prove what you've lost, especially in the short term. So it would be good to have a firm grip on a business reason for going forward in a lawsuit. And if you had to hire an expert very quickly, you'd have everything ramped up for the expert to analyze things and tell you how much these things are worth so they can make a presentation to the court that, goodwill is irreparable and we need an injunction, but if we're actually going to go for money damages down the road, they're worth millions of dollars. As Bob had said earlier, attorney fees in different states are different. In New York, you could have one-sided attorney fees. Provisions in California, for example, you need to be mutual. What do Mr. Appropriators want? Basically anything of value that's not known to the outside world. And, if it's not nailed down, employees will take it. In a lot of instances, employees don't even know that what they're taking is a trade secret or improper. A lot of employees say, I worked on this, it's mine, it's my work product, why can't I take it? So that's part of the audit process, is to educate your employees to what they can and cannot do. And a lot of times that avoids a lot of problems down the road because employees understand what is expected of them and treated like adults and upfront about everything and not trying to hide anything from employees. Usually that'll stop a lot of the lawsuits in their tracks because everybody knows where they stand. I often find for small companies especially vulnerable to trade secret theft, especially startups. An employee works on a project, figures out how to do something, says, well, can't I just do this on my own? So, every audit's got to be different. The small companies have to be particularly aware of losing, basically all their assets right out off the bat, and then they're out of business the next day. Next thing, how do they do it? These are your typical means. There's no secrets here. Most people can email thousands of emails in, an hour to themselves or to their friends. And frankly, a lot of employees might not even know that's improper. So it's important to adopt a strong email policy, and part of the audit is to go through the email policy and, can you work at home? Can you take things at home? And make sure, part of the audit is to make sure you enforce your policies. So if you do go to the court, you can say, Your Honor, they have this policy. They acknowledge this policy repeatedly over and over again, and they still did it. Also thumb drives. I just bought an 80 gig thumb drive for a relatively inexpensive price. You can basically download, a truckload of documents in an hour on a thumb drive. So it's important to have thumb drive policies. When can you use thumb drives? Where can you use them? Are you allowed to do work on thumb drives? Businesses should make decisions on that as well. Next slide. Top 10 things you can do when an employee resigns to join a competitor. We're assuming you know that he's joining a competitor or she's joining a competitor, which is not always the case. But if they do say in an exit interview, I'm joining a competitor, obviously the exit interview should be very clear and concise, that to remind people if they have a non-compete what the confidentiality restrictions are. And they should also, another thing that's important, I think, if it's an important person in the organization, you should probably take their computer and segregate it, because certainly you'd want to go through this high-ranking employee's computer to see if they took or didn't take anything. And just for peace of mind, if you go to litigation as a lawyer, I always want to know that you have the computer intact, because you don't want a spoliation claim in the court saying that, you know, you lost information that you should have kept because this guy told you he was leaving to a competitor and you knew litigation was going to go forward. You know, also there's new type things that, you know, you can go to LinkedIn. For the last few cases I've done, LinkedIn's actually provided a lot of valuable defense and offensive information, because people tend to brag on LinkedIn and they for some reason think that no one's ever going to look at it. So Facebook, the same thing. Suspicious indicators. You know, when you look to your employees and what they're doing, you know, it's common sense, like in business, you know, if people are doing weird things, probably something weird's going on. Tendency for weird things to go on, especially around after a review, people are disgruntled, they start doing things they probably wouldn't want to do. After someone gets a bonus, they suddenly act inappropriately and talk to people. You know, your nose, eyes, ears, and what Rob said earlier, you know, keep your eyes open and also speak to your clients to see what's going on. Audit your information. Well, as we, you know, this is a program about auditing, you know, the overall goal would be to, you know, basically three steps would be to identify and document what your trade secrets and confidential information are. You'd want to segregate and secure this information, you know, whether it's labeling it confidential or physically moving certain documents so certain employees don't have access to it. And then adopting best practices for protocols and procedures, you know, having the right policies. And, you know, basically the way the courts look at this is you have to make reasonable efforts under the circumstances. So an IBM or an Apple should have, you know, the best policies and protocols possible if they want to protect their trade secrets and confidential information. If it's a mom-and-pop store, the courts will say, you know, you did the best you could under the circumstances with a limited budget. But the end result of all this would be coming up, working with your lawyers, whoever they may be, to come up with a trade secret protection plan that's tailored to your company. And that'll put you in a good position to know what you have and how to protect it. Next slide. And these are the same, similar things that we've been talking about now. You know, a trade secret audit, it's not just to protect your assets, but it's, as I said, it's a defense that another company won't sue you for wrongful hiring one of their programs, because part of your onboarding process would be to make sure that your employee doesn't have in writing any trade secrets from his former employer. So you can use that as a defense. You can also say, we've had this information for years, you know, it's been well documented, so if you think we took something that's valuable to you, you're wrong, because we don't need it, and we're comfortable with stating that, because we have it well documented. And again, as we've mentioned before, the trade secret audit is a very, very good tool to have if you need to run to court very quickly. You don't have to create the wheel in 2 weeks and, you know, spend 80 hours just trying to figure out what the company has, because you've done it over the course of several months and updating it with your lawyers over time. Again, audits are key. You know, work with your outside counsel that has an objective feel for what a court would want. An objective feel for, you know, working with many, many companies in different venues. That was what's important in the audit. Certainly, they will talk to the company leaders and see what they think is important, but companies that try to do this in-house sometimes don't have a big picture. You know, we're giving you a checklist of things to look for, but you know, merely checking the box isn't always going to do it. That may be a good first step, but really knowing the ins and outs of the law, even as practitioners, you know, if I have a problem in California, I would never feel comfortable doing something in California without calling Rob or Bob, because it's just, you know, even though if you do this for 20 years, things change and the law is always changing and what is important and not important. You really need to have a hands-on experience. And basically, the bottom line is you need to do it right with qualified people, part of process. You know, pretty self-evident, we can read these for ourselves, but you have to classify, you have to have protection policy, you have to have support for all your positions, and you want to limit the risk of exposure of the company's claims of misappropriation that we talked about before. I had to talk about this before, you know, all your agreements. It's important to make sure you have agreements that reflect current technology because it's always changing. I think Robert will talk about cloud computing a little bit and just, you know, privacy issues. I mean, certain lawyers spend their whole career just trying to figure out privacy issues. And Bob said something about wage and hour laws. There's a lot of interrelationship between different laws in these agreements. And I often see clients just, you know, get a Bloomberg form and cut and paste and put a form together and say, oh, I have a trade secret policy of a non-compete provision, and then you go to court and the judges look at you and say, this is just a form agreement that's not tailored, that doesn't reflect anything, that you ran down the employee's throat, and we're not going to enforce it. So, I mean, it's worth a few dollars, I think, especially if you have key employees, to spend some time, look at your agreements, and have good overall company policies that the company will live with, or not live with, but understand what you're doing. So, again, if something bad happens, you know what you're getting yourself into and not running around with a fire drill. Putting a plan into place, we talked about that a little more, but, you know, I think the key here is to, from my perspective, is to educate the workforce what you expect as an employer and what you really want your employees to live by. And I think a lot of times, if employees know what's expected of them right up front, that, you know, they're going to be exposed to trade secrets, that anything developed is the company's, that's their property. And you tell them repeatedly. You know, I've seen companies that send emails around every couple of months saying, no, this is confidential information, you can't share this, check this box to acknowledge that you got this. And that's actually pretty powerful evidence in court. Even just merely stamping something confidential will sometimes help you. You don't want people just randomly stamp documents, but if you stamp something confidential and people know it's confidential, they tend to treat it as confidential, and then they leave, they'll think twice about taking anything with them. You know, there's nothing foolproof, but it's kind of like sexual harassment training. You have to tell the employees, you know, what's wrong and what's right, and you have to keep monitoring what's going on in the workplace, and you need to keep educating your employees. It's really no different than that. Again, repeated reminders here are key. Training, we've gone through that again, especially new employees. You want to open up a dialogue, tell them what you expect, and continue to educate. And that it's not just a one-time, you stop thing. It should be mandatory that especially high-level people that have access to important information that they're continually reminded of their obligations. This is just a funny cartoon that Robert found, just highlighting the fact that, you know, you never know who's going to be around and what's in, how people are using information. So this is, as a trade secret lawyer, we all think this is funny, but maybe a lot of other people wouldn't. Okay, hiring, again, we went through this a little bit. If you tell people right up front not to bring trade secrets from other employers, that's important to get that in writing. We're taking this seriously. And it's also a defense of litigation. And also, agreement should provide that the company will terminate and seek damages from employees who fail to disclose prior agreements. That's something to talk about, depending on what type of information was taken. Departing employees, same thing. This could be your last opportunity to enforce your rights. And if you really think, you know, the other example was you knew employees going to competitor, but most of the times you don't know where they're going to go, and that should raise some eyebrows, and you should start snooping around. If an employee doesn't tell you where they're going to go, that's definitely a red flag. A lot of agreements up front will say, when you leave employment here, you have to, as part of your exiting package, tell us where you're going to go, and we have the right to contact your new employer and notify them of all our non-competes or confidentiality agreements that we have with you. that's something you can do. And if you run to court, if you think someone's going to inevitably disclose something that's a term that's thrown out before, a threatened misappropriation claim, you need to be able to show the court something why you're so nervous. And if you can say at the exit interview they failed to return some of your property, they failed to sign an agreement that they promised they'd sign when they left, stating that they didn't take anything or they're not going to a competitor, at least the court will listen to you. And that will give you some ammunition to try to get that TRO that we talked about before. And now I think that we're going to give you the code for the CLE, and then Robert will continue with technology.
To receive CLE credit for this webinar, please write down the following code on the CLE attendance affirmation form that you will receive following the webinar. Please submit the form to the person indicated on that form. The code is SS9322. Again, SS as in Cyphos Shaw 9322.
Okay, at this point we wanted to talk about technology and how that plays a role in a trade secret audit. And taking into account the latest and greatest in technology is very important as part of a trade secret audit. You know, today there's a massive use of cell phones and iPhones and the use of USB devices, as well as other changes in technology such as companies going to cloud computing. And by that I mean not hosting their own data, but using third parties to host their data. So there's all these changes that are constantly occurring in technology that companies need to be abreast of when looking at their trade secrets and making sure that their trade secrets are adequately protected. And that's what an audit does. It takes a look at how the data is presently being protected. And that's the key part of an analysis on a trade secret audit, is an assessment of the electronic security practices and procedures and in places that are in place, and also making recommendations about how to better protect that information. So as part of an audit, it's essential that you have knowledge of what the current in technology that exists, you know, the use of USB devices, the use of personal email, cloud computing. Also, as part of an audit, we'll often use a computer forensic examiner who can provide some tips and recommendations about how a company is presently protecting their information and where they may be vulnerable. There's certain technology and software that's available that companies can employ to alert them when there's massive downloading of information and putting USB blocks on particular computers, and also just setting up secure networks, for example, for your research and development department. If you just want to have that to be a secure network that only employees of that particular department have access to instead of the whole company, those are things that computer security specialists and forensic examiners are useful for assisting in an audit. You know, with the advent of technology, the use of iPhones, portable music players, and cell phones, it's very easy for employees to transfer data and companies' data easily. And sometimes that's just part of the job, and actually employers want to encourage that. But at the same time, they have to keep in mind the more access and the more willingness that they're allowed to let information be easily transferable, the more risk there is to their data. And that's why it's so important in conducting a trade secret audit, first getting a handle on what the trade secret information is, how it's being protected, and is the company comfortable with those current protections. Oftentimes, recommendations are in encrypting the data or limiting the access to the data to only those who need to know. And, of course, if litigation commences, pointing to your particular electronic security policies and what was permissible access and what was permissible use is often key, because if there was something that was allowed and the employee has a good excuse as to why they didn't return it or why they accessed a particular database, it can be problematic in litigation. Another key thing to take in mind is the explosion of social networking and how employees are using many social networking sites at work and at home, and how there's a threat to trade secrets being disclosed in those particular venues. And that's why it's important for companies to have social media policies, and that's one thing that we look at in a trade secret audit. There's one case that I wanted to highlight for you that we'll briefly go over with you, that that's key in understanding some of the protections that companies need to have in place. It's the Sasquatch Group versus Courtney case, and it had to deal with a headhunting company and an employee from the headhunting company leaving, and then there was an allegation that the particular employee stole the customer list. And the court in this particular case found that there was no trade secret misappropriation, and the analysis focused on two key areas. First, the court found that there was not reasonable secrecy measures employed, and so there was therefore not a trade secret. The court found that there was no confidentiality or no non-solicitation agreement with the employee. And the other thing that the court pointed to is that the measures in place to protect the customer database were not reasonable under the circumstances. There were no passwords, remote access was allowed, data was freely shared with business partners, and there were no firewalls or securities. So those are kind of common sense, big red flags, but it just goes to show you that any one of these could have been instrumental in the court making a different decision. The other key thing about this case is the court talked about the nature of the information involved and that the actual customer information that they were trying to protect. The employee that left argued, well, that information is publicly available. I can go on to LinkedIn and find out who the customers are, who the customers for this particular headhunting company are, what their preferences are, what their history are, and who would be good targets. And the court actually bought that argument. And the employee actually demonstrated to the court how easy it was to find that information through Google searches and searches on Bloomberg and other periodical sites. And the court found that the type of data that they were trying to protect may not qualify for protection under the Uniform Trade Secret Act in the 21st century because it could be found in a matter of minutes and it was publicly available. And what the court said was, in the past, this particular information regarding clients' preferences, hiring practices, and business strategies may very well have been a protectable trade secret early in the company's existence. However, for good or bad, the exponential proliferation of information made available through the Internet and the powerful tools it provides makes this information not protectable in 2010. And so I think that that's a development that is going to continue to be an issue in the future as more and more information becomes publicly available and companies still try to protect that information, arguing that it's a protectable customer list. We're moving up towards our deadline, so I'll quickly go through this. One of the new areas is cloud computing, and as part of a trade secret audit, special consideration needs to be whether trade secrets should be placed in the cloud and whether companies should enter into agreements where they host their data through third parties. And some of the key steps there are understanding, make sure you pick the right cloud provider, do due diligence, make sure that this is not a cloud provider that's going to disappear. If that cloud provider disappears, where's your data going to go and what security features are going to be in place to get that data back? The other key thing with respect to cloud computing is also social media. And social media is a form of cloud computing, your LinkedIn, your Twitter, your Facebook, and making sure that you have good social media policies with your employees, prohibiting the posting of trade secrets and confidential information on social media sites. With respect to best practices on cloud computing contracts, it's important in the cloud computing sector that you designate that the data that the cloud provider is hosting belongs to the company, not the cloud provider. It's also important to designate what happens when the contract ends and where the information is going to go. If you're relying upon a cloud provider, it's important to know about where your data is going to be hosted and what's going to happen if that particular station goes down. Is there going to be a backup center, and do you have a backup plan? The other key thing to bear in mind is in your contract, make sure that you have a clear handle on your data and what's going to happen if there's a dispute over services or payment for the services, that you're still going to have access to the data and there's not going to be a delay. And also make sure in your contract that you have provisions dealing with the transition and the moving of data to a new provider if there is a dispute or you just want to change providers. And make sure that you restrict the use of the data and don't allow the cloud provider to use or sell the data. That's obviously going to impact the trade secret status of the data. and make sure in your contract, to the extent you have the bargaining power, that you hold the cloud provider and subcontractors liable if there's any data breaches, or if they inadvertently disclose, make your trade secret information publicly available, that they be held responsible and that there's not a cutoff of the consequential damages in the contract. As far as social media policies, that's something that's also addressed in the trade secret audit. And as we stated, there should be a clear prohibition in the social media policy about posting trade secrets and confidential information. But make sure it's not too broad, because if it's too broad, the NLRB has been cracking down on too broad of social media policies, basically prohibiting the employees to make any sort of comments about their employer on social media sites. The NLRB has come down and filed complaints against employers who had policies that were that broad, arguing that that was effectively prohibiting protected activity to unionize and engage in concerted activities. There's two cases recently, the NLRB versus American Medical Response. In that particular case, the employee posted negative comments about a supervisor on Facebook, and the NLRB sued that particular employer for that action. Another case was against Thomson Reuters, where they posted a negative comment on a Twitter account criticizing management, and again, the NLRB got involved. So the key takeaway there is part of the audit, make sure that the policy is tethered to protection of trade secrets and not too broad to prohibit information that could be protected under federal law or under the First Amendment. And it's important in drafting your social media policy that it's communicated to the employees and that you, in this policy, that you indicate that not only that intentional disclosure is prohibited as well as accidental disclosure. And part of the education process that David was talking about is that you can really get that across to the employees by focusing on what are the licensees policies of these companies like Facebook and Twitter. Essentially, when a user is posting information on these particular sites, they're providing a license to Facebook and Twitter for that information. So the parade of horrors is that they inadvertently or intentionally post your trade secret information on these sites, and effectively they've provided a license to these cloud providers to use the information. So once the sort of the cat's out of the bag with your trade secrets on these social media sites, it can be a real problem to get the information back and still try to protect it as a trade secret. So we recommend including that as part of the education process of why it's so important to uphold to the social media policy. We're running a little bit short on time, but obviously we'll be providing you with the slides and a checklist on the audit procedures. At this point, I'll turn it back over to Robert and David, who are going to provide the typical audit recommendations that come out of the audit process.
Hi, this is Bob again. I know we're running late. One of the things that I always want to have from clients is their confidentiality agreements and the agreements that they say protect their trade secrets. And if yours is, if you're in California, you've got to have that looked at least once a year. And certainly, if you have one that's 3 years old right now, you're going to run afoul of the Edwards case. And there's been language that says that if you have non-compete clauses in your employee contract, that you could also run afoul of Business and Professions Code 17200 for trying to engage your employee in unfair business practices. And David, I'll let you have the last slide if you don't mind on trade secret audit checklist, please.
I think it's pretty self-explanatory, and you can go through, like Bob said, we gave you some information, but the auditing contact information sheet would be key for me to figure out who has the proper information and who's the person responsible for communicating certain policy statements that the company wants to implement. So that, getting the team together would be very important. And again, defining the trade secret, that's where it all is, because it's never an easy task, and a lot of minds would vary on what they think a trade secret is. That's why it's important to sit down and figure out what's important to the company and how to best make and protect what could be a trade secret and not lose that protection. So I think that, is it the last slide? Questions?
Yes, and those who need to go, feel free to leave at this point, but we did receive a few questions, and I think we have some time to to answer those, one question we have is that if a company doesn't have confidentiality agreements in place currently with its employees to protect trade secrets, what can that employee do to obtain confidentiality agreements from its current workforce that will be enforced by the courts? What do you think about that, Bob?
I'm sorry.
I can answer it. I was
scrolling through something else.
That question actually comes up quite a bit. You do have just some common law rights to your confidential information. So even if you don't have an actual written agreement, you could certainly try to go to court on a common law theme, at least in New York or New Jersey. But generally, if you don't have a written agreement with your employees, you can implement that and even implement a non-compete, because certainly in New York, continued employment would be considered consideration for an employee to sign a confidentiality agreement. So you could, obviously you would want to think this through with your lawyers, but you just actually continuing employment, you can request that your employee sign a confidentiality and or non-compete agreement in New York or New Jersey.
Yeah, and I think that's essential. I mean, if you have employees that are not bound by any confidentiality agreement, you need to get those employees bound by a confidentiality agreement. There may be some nuanced jurisdictions where you may need to massage that, but in general, there's no prohibition on rolling out a confidentiality agreement to existing employees, and you can roll that out as part of your employee handbook or a standalone confidentiality agreement. But I would do that sooner rather than later, because if that employee turns out to be an employee that takes your trade secrets, one of the key things that the courts look to about reasonable secrecy measures is whether you told this employee and you have an agreement with this employee that they have to keep the information confidential. One last question that we got has to do with cloud computing, and in holding cloud providers liable for disclosing trade secrets, does this have to be in your contract with them, or is there some sort of policy apart from the contract that you could rely upon? And I think that there the best practice is that you would have some sort of indemnification provision in the contract. A lot of these contracts depend upon the bargaining power, and a lot of them are form contracts, and the cloud provider likes to limit their damages to a nominal dollar amount and cuts off damages for consequential damages. So in those instances, that's why it's so important to protect to select a good cloud computing provider after doing due diligence and try to bargain for notification on consequential damages. Certainly, if they were responsible for the disclosure of the trade secret, your best theory would be by contract, and you'd sort of be swimming upstream unless you could show that there was some sort of intentional misappropriation by the cloud provider. If it was just negligent conduct by the cloud provider that led to the disclosure of your trade secrets, your best recourse is going to be some sort of breach of contract theory under the cloud contract.
This is Bob. There's one more question that I think we can answer quickly. That is, if a company does not have a confidentiality agreement in place with its employees to protect trade secrets, what can the company do to obtain confidentiality agreements from its current workforce? Well, there's a couple of things. If you have periodic contracts that you enter into annually or biannually or every 2 years or so with employees, that's when you put that new provision in there for the trade secret. Or you can just create a new contract that will include trade secrets. If you do that, be careful and find out what in your jurisdiction may be required. Sometimes courts require that there be additional consideration to enter into a confidentiality agreement, and other courts don't require that there be any additional consideration. It's just part of the employment process. Thank you.
Thank you for your time and participating in today's trade secret audit webinar. We will be having another audit. We'll be having another webinar, the third in our series. Tentatively it's scheduled for June, and it'll be on statute in Georgia on non-compete agreements. So thanks for your time, and please look to our website to sign up for the next trade secret webinar. It's www.tradesecretslaw.com. Thank you for your time.